I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to Minute 127 of Season 6 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is another very special guest after yesterday's special guest. I have a film historian and the CEO of Virgil Films Entertainment, Joe Amadei. Welcome back to the show, Joe. It's been six or five seasons since you've been on, so I appreciate you coming back. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. So much has happened during those five seasons. It seems like it was yesterday we were talking about
it. Really does.
Hills.
That's right.
Yeah, and The Great Escape.
That's right. So I mean, and I'm really glad that you reached out to me and we're interested in joining for the season two. So. I appreciate you taking the time to join us here.
Well, it's very interesting. I don't know how much has been discussed about, well about the making of It's a Wonderful Life.
We've talked about it for 126 minutes, but you know,
but you know, picture me as a 13-year-old, kind of a shy kid. But I know I love movies, and sitting upstairs in my bedroom with a little portable black and white TV and watching It's a Wonderful Life on PBS, because at that point it was in the public domain and everybody showed it. I had never heard of Frank Capra, and feeling that my life was changing at the end of the film and going downstairs and saying to my parents, I just watched this movie called It's a Wonderful Life and I want to make movies. Or I want to be in the movie business.
I thought it was The Great Escape that made you want to watch, want to make movies.
All right, they both did. But the what It's a Wonderful Life did, to get even deeper, was to show me how movies can affect people's thoughts and opinions and how they live their lives.
Wow. Because
the story of It's a Wonderful Life is, you know, it's very simple. It's helping others. It's putting your community first, sometimes at your own, I don't want to say jeopardy, but sometimes at your own loss. And that's what George Bailey does throughout the entire film, and thinking that he is a failure because he never became a architect or a wonderful success with a big house and a lot of money. And what he comes to realize by the end of the film is that he is a success. And he is the greatest guy in town, because he has spent his life helping people through the building and loan, but not just through the building and loan, but just being the type of guy that he is. So it affected me in that respect. The Great Escape, it showed me that, you know, you can entertain the heck out of people by making a really good film. But yeah, It's a Wonderful Life had a deep and a deep effect on me. And at the time, no one knew this film. I mean, my mom and dad, who were film goers, kind of remembered it. But it wasn't, you know, they remembered other Capra films a lot more than they remembered It's a Wonderful Life. It wasn't the sensation that it became 4 or 5 years later. And now it's, you know, everybody you talk to, oh, It's a Wonderful Life is my favorite film. I'm like, okay, that's great. Yeah, it's been my favorite film since I was 12. So it really did, and I'm a lot older than 12 now, but even to this day,
you're like 22 now, right?
I just turned 23.
22. Oh, sorry about that. Yeah.
So anyway, just it played a big effect on me, and still you know, I still believe in its message and Capra's message and the message from the short story it came from and all that other stuff.
Yeah, I'm assuming you've read the short story, the Greatest Gift.
Oh yeah, I have it. I have it here in a little book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not a great little. No, not a great
short story. It really isn't.
It really isn't. You know,
brush salesman. But, you know, come on.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I'm glad that it was able to, you know, that Capra and Joe Swirley were able to use that as the jumping board in order to give them something a lot more profound to talk about.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So, yeah.
And go ahead. Yep. So there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if you realize this. Do you know the names of the two angels besides Clarence?
I don't off the top. If I really, really think about it, but no, I don't.
Okay.
Well, I know there's. He talks to Gabriel, doesn't he?
No, no. There's Joseph.
Oh, right? Wow.
And there's Franklin. So
Joseph, I recall. Franklin, I don't.
Okay, wow. So Franklin's the big guy, I guess you can say. Joseph's the one who Clarence talks to most of the time. And so my theory is, and I don't know if it's correct or not, is that you know, when Capra and Joe Swirling wrote this, they basically named those two characters after themselves. You know, Franklin is Frank Capra. Yeah. You know, he's basically God.
Oh, yeah.
and his right hand man is, you know, his writer, Joe Swirling. So, you know, I thought that's gotta be it.
I mean, yeah, I'd have to go back and pull out my you know, Capra's autobiography and, you know, read the section on It's a Wonderful Life. But yeah, that's interesting. How about that?
Yeah, again, this is my theory because I never read it anywhere. I tried figuring it out. I mean, we don't even know who does one of the voices. We only know who does I think Joseph, that voice.
Yeah.
We know who it is, but we have absolutely no idea who does the voice of Franklin. For all we know, it was Capra who did it himself. I don't know. I mean, I don't think I could say that I would know what Capra's voice sounds like. So, you know,
One of them sounds a little bit like Lewis Stone, but I don't think it is. A little bit. But again, it could have been, you're right, it could be anybody. Most of the time, they were never billed, and they weren't in the credits.
Right. I mean, the senior angel is Maroni Olson. I don't know. Are you familiar with who that is?
Nope. No. I'd have to look him up.
So, I mean, we talked about him, you know, the first week, but sure. You know, just to remind you and everyone else who he is, and this shocked me. When I also when I first read it at the time, that he is the magic mirror in Snow White and Seven Dwarfs.
Oh, wow!
He did the voice for the magic mirror, which is even more interesting because we even have the voice of Snow White in this movie. You know, the singer, the singing right. voice of Snow White.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember what her name was. We talked about this a few weeks ago also. Can't remember her name either right now.
The woman that did the voice of Snow White.
So I just think it's amazing that this movie gives us, you know, both of those voices. I mean, this is 8 years after Snow White came out.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. They all were in the same community. Though that community was broken up somewhat because of the war. So it's interesting that she would, you know, still be around, you know, 8 years later. That's very interesting.
Right. No, she was around for, again, we talked about this a few weeks ago.
A long
time. She lived a very long life. I mean, Maroni, Maroni passed in 1954. So we're talking only, you know, 8 years after the movie, but Adriana Castellotti. I think that's who it is.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And she died in 1997. Wow. So, you know, it's still, you know, she died 27 years ago, but still, you know. She was born in 1916. So she lived to the age of 80.
Well, you know, she had seven little guys taking care of her.
Hey,
That'll
if
get
that
me.
helps.
It'll win a lot of hearts and minds that I just said that. But you know, I recently, about a year ago, I watched Snow White again, and it is an amazing film as a film, a piece of work. It holds
It
up.
holds up, but it's a little slow. You know,
No, I didn't
I find
find it
parts of
slow. I
it,
find Sleeping
I
Beauty
find parts of
slow.
it really, really slow of Snow White.
Yeah, not for me. Some of the other Disney, I find Dumbo slow. Pinocchio is brilliant. Fantasia puts me to sleep at times, but
Yeah, parts of them, but Fantasia, I mean, obviously Fantasia's got some great segments also. That's the thing I never liked about Fantasia and the sequel to Fantasia, Fantasia 2000, is that some of the stuff they do there is amazing, and some of them are just, like you said, they put you to sleep. So, yeah, exactly. All right, so minute 127 begins with the party just getting started, and ends with Ernie trying to quiet down the crowd. So,
Yes, it does. And that party, you know, there are some, you know, the real key to that party is, in this entire section, when George comes home, is that Capra brings in characters that were beloved in the first part of the film, and then during the segment of George going back into Bedford Falls and seeing and what their fate has turned into when he wasn't there.
that's
And
right.
the first person I believe you see is Mr. Martini, and
No,
he's
not yet. We're not a martini yet. First, because we ended yesterday giving each other a hug, being very happy, and then Uncle Billy says, "Merry Christmas and God bless you." And then Ma Bailey goes, "Merry Christmas." And you know, people are you know, the room is very what's the word for it? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on.
You know, there's tons of people who have just joined, you know, within seconds, coming into
Yes,
this
within
room,
seconds.
and they do it well. And then, you know, we have Ernie standing there, and Ernie looks like he's the MC with the way that
He
he's
is
like
the MC.
introducing
Yes.
people. He goes, "Oh, Mr. Martini," and then "Merry Christmas," and then Ernie goes, "Martini, step right up here." And we see that Martini's carrying like a bowl. He's got like a
Yeah, and
bowl
he says,
filled.
"I busted the jukebox."
That's right. He goes, "I busted the jukebox too." And everyone starts laughing. You know. And then as he's doing that, he like pours all the money that's there into, you know, onto the table.
the
Now,
pile of money.
what I find really interesting, and we'll get a little bit more into this over the next few days, but you know, people are giving money. But nobody is, you know, we're gonna talk about in I think it's on Friday's episode, we'll talk about the fact that the Eustace is counting the money, but nobody's paying attention to how much each person gave. You know?
No.
So it's like, okay, we need to make sure we have $8,000, but you know, how much did Martini give? Did you know, with Martini with all of his nickels and dimes from the jukebox, you know, is he in the end giving him $5 or is he giving him $50? You know, and
Well,
Martini.
but the question is, are they investing that money, or are they donating that money? They're just giving it to make sure that George does not go bankrupt.
Correct.
Are they expecting a return on the $5 here, or on the, you know, the subsequent folks to come in and give, you know, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you know, give $5 here, or $3 here, or $10 here, or my take on this has always been they're just giving him the money, and the only time there's a loan comes, you know, a little bit later in this scene.
Which we'll talk, I think we talk about that tomorrow. The so all right. So Martini dumps everything out from the bowl onto the table. George is smiling; he's very happy. Now, did you notice that after Martini walks away, we have a character that we haven't met at all throughout the entire movie that shows up to give money,
Yes, I do.
and you know, if. In order to try and stay as politically correct as possible, if this was done today, it would be okay. We're just giving a token person that we've never seen, you know, in yeah. Bedford Falls
yeah.
showing up. But it's just very strange because we have Annie who plays right. the token
maid
exactly. But who's this woman? We've never seen her.
Yeah. And I don't, you know, it could have just been an extra hanging around the set, or it could have been somebody that was, you know, had a 2-minute storyline or a 1-minute storyline that was cut. I don't know. But you're right. It's out of nowhere.
Yeah. It just jumped out at me because, right. But it jumped out at me because here we have, you know, another African-American woman that is just not at all mentioned throughout this entire movie. You know, and she's just here. You know, we don't know who she is. Maybe she did have a scene. Maybe she's like one of Annie's friends or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but as you said, I mean, when you're watching this movie, normally you won't notice this. It just, it goes by within a few seconds. But when you're watching it the way we're watching it, you do notice these things. I can honestly say, I mean, I probably have not seen this movie as many times as you have. I've probably seen it probably about 20 times in my life. But I've never noticed her before.
this happens before Mr. Gower.
That's right. She shows up before Mr. Gower shows up.
Right.
And then everyone's laughing, and then she moves out of the way and gives Ernie a hug, and then we see Mr. Gower show up, and then Mr. Gower actually says something very interesting. He goes, "I made the rounds on all my charge accounts."
I know. So what Mr. Gary did is anybody that owed him money, he went and got the money so he could give it to George.
That's right. It's not that Mr. Gower, he's going over to someone's house and saying, "Hey, you owe me money. Give me the money so I can go pay George." You know, and
that's exactly what he does. Everybody is there to help George because George has helped them.
Correct. But I mean, one of the things that gets me is that, you know, December 24th, 1945. Do you know what day of the week it is? Or it was?
I do not. I know, just know it's Christmas Eve. I don't know what day of the week. What is it, a Sunday?
No, it's a Monday. Okay. This is all on a Monday. So this is Monday night. So basically Mr. Gower on Christmas Eve has been going house to house, caroling, and when people open the door, he says, "Oh, by the way, you owe me $10. You owe me this." You know, he's like taking the money back in order to be able to pay George. It's a very strange idea to think about, that this is what Mr. Gower is doing.
But I also think what Mr. Gower is probably saying is George is in trouble, and everybody knows George because everybody knows the Bailey Building and loan. And he may say, you know, if we don't raise enough money, Potter is going to take over the building and loan, and everybody hates Henry Potter. So, you know, he may be saying to these people that he's, you know, asking, "Hey, pay your bill, pay off your charge account so we can help out George."
Yeah, that's very possible. But I just find it very strange that this line in the movie where he's actually saying that he went, you know, to go get it from the charge accounts. I mean, I guess it goes along with the fact that we just had Martini say, "I broke the jukebox," you know, in order to.
But the charge account back then, it's not like a credit card or anything like that. You know, it was very common in the 30s and 40s and even the 50s. And even in my childhood, the local grocery store, the corner store, not like a grocery store, like a
Acme, not a supermarket. It wasn't a supermarket. It was a small. I mean, we have those here in Israel where people
We had a tab.
People in my country, people still do that. They have at the local grocery store, not the big chains or anything like that, where they have a tab, and therefore their kids can go get what they want, and they just put it on the parents' tab and stuff like that. Yeah. So
that's what Sarah was doing.
Yeah. You know, people are getting ice cream there and licorice and all that stuff. So it makes sense, but it's just a very strange comment for him to say. You know, that this, like, why do all the characters need to tell us where they got the money?
I just think it's I don't think they necessarily have to say it, but the difference would be if they came and didn't say anything.
Right.
You want to have some dialogue in there. And I guess for, you know, for Gower and Martini, you know, saying, you know, where they got the money. You know, the bust of the jukebox is funny.
Yes,
you know?
That is.
We get that. You know, the charge account, it could be looked at it, you know, a bunch of different ways. I find it to be you know, funny as well.
Right. I mean, I like the fact that he has this big
guy going door to door. You know, it's not even probable at this point. It is Christmas Eve. But, you know, it's part of movie, whatever you want to call it, movie mystery that he's able to even do that in that time period.
Exactly. And I like the fact that he has this big, like jar that he's basically stuffed all the money into. So, you know, so
wonderful, though. It's great.
It really is. But to me, it's reminiscent of the fact that he was basically panhandling in the alternate universe, you know, and here that's more or less what he's doing also. He's just not drunk when he's doing it.
Yeah, that actually that's goes into your, you know, minute by minute look at this film. Maybe it's too much.
Yeah. No, again, I'm not saying I'm against it. It's just interesting the way that they do that. And George is extremely happy, and he gets like a pat on the back from Mrs. Hatch,
right,
who is also showing you know, that she cares about George, you know, which is nice Hatch, also.
Without Mrs. Hatch, this doesn't happen.
That's true. Awesome.
Right. She's the hero of the film. I mean, she goes out and gets everybody together. And
no, you're talking about Mary. I'm not talking about Mary. I'm talking about Mary's mother.
Oh, you're talking about the mother.
Yeah, I was very interested to hear how Mary's mother was the hero of this movie. I thought that's what you were about to tell me. She's the hero because
Wainwright's on the other line. Get off the phone.
That's right.
Whatever.
And then the procession continues, and so then we have Gloria Graham show up, you know, Violet Bick, and
does she give money though?
She does, and oh, she what? Does. And where's that money? That's basically she's giving George back his money that he gave her earlier in the day.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He gave her money to leave.
That's right. So I just find it really funny, you know. And she says, "I'm not going to go, George. I changed my mind." Now, I don't really know how she is affected by the fact that George needs money and therefore she decides to stay. Like, what's going through her mind? Is she basically saying to herself, okay, George needs this money more than I do, so I'm not going to leave? Or, like what could have made her change her mind to stay? You know, maybe she's saying, I think maybe one day, I'm going to be able to, you know, to kick Mary out of the way and I'll get George for myself. I don't know.
Well, there's that thinking, but then there's also the thinking, I'm not going to be a bad girl anymore. And George, you kind of showed me that, and the kindness that you showed me by giving me money to get out of town, I'm going to make it here. And, you know, I know your brother's coming back from the war. So, hey.
Well, the truth is we don't know. We don't know if Harry's still married because we never see Ruth after their.
We never see her again. Yeah.
We never see her.
That's true.
So maybe, you know, maybe she's dead. Maybe they got divorced. You know, who knows? we don't even know if Harry had any kids. I mean, there's certain things completely open. So you're right. Maybe she's like, well, if I can't get George, I'll go after his brother. That's actually not a bad thing.
Yeah, I just think that was another sign of how George Bailey affected someone, and he you know, just by his mere presence and by his kindness, she decided to stay in Bedford Falls, a decent life there.
Right, but she's got a bad reputation is in Bedford Falls. If she goes elsewhere, she can start off from scratch and have a good reputation. So I don't know.
Yeah, and she may still end up leaving Bedford Falls, but at this point, at least for the Christmas holiday, and she also decided that the money that George gave her out of his own pocket might be, you know, he might need that money, and so why would she take that money after hearing what has happened with George? She's like, okay, I'm not leaving. I'm going to give him his money back.
Exactly.
showing kindness for kindness.
That's very true. And then after, I mean, again, I love the way that they just are, as you mentioned earlier, they're bringing us character after character who we've met throughout the last 126 minutes of this movie. And each of them is coming in. They have this one liner that they're saying to George, you know, as they're, you know, basically we're finding the bookend for each of these characters, you know?
Yes.
And then the crowd parts, and we have Annie making her way. She looks like it's funny. It reminds me, you know, like when you have sporting events where you're introducing the team, and everyone, you know, each player on the team, and they come down and they slap everyone's hands, you know, as they're going through the procession. And it looks like that's what she's doing because she's coming with a lot of energy.
Right. Yes, she is.
Oh, for sure.
She has a lot of energy.
I mean, her character has a lot of energy. And then George says, "Oh, Annie," and she goes. And she takes out her money and starts putting it onto the table. And she says, "I've been saving this money for a divorce. If ever I get myself a husband."
Yeah.
And everyone laughs. And she says, "Merry Christmas." I mean, it's a nice way to give us closure on each of these characters as things. I think her statement is a little bit, too public of a statement for her to say, but I guess, you know, when you're with friends and family, you can say whatever you want, you know, but she's still optimistic that she's going to find her husband at some point. Yeah. And then we see Mary on the side, who basically looks like she's about to cry out of joy, out of, you know, the generosity of everyone, you know, that's coming. And then, that's not over at all. And then this is actually my favorite of all the people who show up. You know, we have, and he basically is holding a wad of cash in both hands and is just slowly letting all the money fall onto the table. And, you know, he has a nice line also. And he goes, "There you are, George. I got the faculty all up and out of bed." So he went in and woke everyone up, all the other teachers. Again, we don't know exactly what time this is. It can't be that late, but I would say it's probably about 9, 10 o'clock at night already at this point.
And it's he up, but he didn't wake up the teacher that George insulted on the phone, you know.
Okay, but Mrs. Welch, 40 minutes. But then again, Mrs. Welch is a kindergarten teacher. So, you know, we know he's the high school principal. So it could be a different school. It could be the same school. You know, that would have been really interesting if we had Mr. Welch show up and give him money also. You know, and actually that probably would have been a little too much.
Yes, exactly.
You know, to do that. Yeah.
That's too much. Yeah.
And then he takes out his pocket, lets it swing as if he's about to hypnotize Zuzu. And then he says to her, "Here's something for you to play with." And then we have some other character who... we've seen him, remember what his name is, because he's not really introduced before, and he basically pushes through the crowd and goes, "I would have a roof over my head if it wasn't for you, George."
Oh yeah, yes, I remember. Yes,
you know, and then he takes out some money. He has like a can of money that he pours out onto the table also. And again, the whole time George is laughing and stuff like
but
that.
But that character basically is representing all of the people that were able to get loans and have houses built in that neighborhood that George drives out to sometime in the movie.
Right.
And
Bailey Park.
I forget the character's name that buys the house and they show the house.
No, we see Martini. That's Martini.
Martini?
Yeah, we see Martini earlier on. Not this guy.
And I just saw online the house. If it is the same house, and it sure does look like the same house, it looks like Capra filmed the outside of that house in a neighborhood outside of Pasadena. And they, you know, online it shows what the house looked like in the movie and what the house looks like today. And it's the exact same house.
Wow. That's really
cool. I haven't investigated it yet. And I do go to LA every once in a while, and I do try to find sites like this, and I have it noted, and you know, try to find like really rare places in LA where they made movies. I do a lot of Chaplin investigations and try to find exactly where he filmed this scene or where he filmed that scene. And just recently I saw this house. I'm like, wow, I wonder if it's the real, if it's that house, because why would Capra go to outside of Pasadena and just film the exterior of a house? Then again, maybe he, I don't know. This all just happened in the past couple of days.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Good luck with that.
Yeah, very cool.
And then to cap off the minute, we have Ernie trying to quiet everyone down. He goes, just a minute. Quiet, everyone. Quiet. And then that's where the minute actually ends.
That's where the minute ends, yes.
Yeah. So did you have any?
Great beginning. Because it kind of starts a little bit before that. But, you know, it's leading into, you know, what is really going to happen, the saving of George and Mary Bailey and the saving of the building and loan, and the failure of Potter, the evil Potter, to take it over. You can see it happening. You can see it really begin to happen. And then, you know, in the next minute or two, some even more major things happen on a financial level.
I like the fact that, I mean, and I know Capra didn't do this on purpose, that this minute ends with this entire procession. You know, like this minute that we've just talked about, the last 60 seconds, you know, has this procession of all these other all these characters. And, you know, it cuts right at the end, you know, because what Ernie is starting to talk about, which everyone will have to come back tomorrow to find out exactly what it is that he says. But that's like starting another chapter of this.
I agree. Yes.
Of this thing. So it's a great bookend the way that works.
Yes.
Right. All right. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
No, I don't. I'm good with this minute. It's a great minute.
Yeah, it is. So every Wednesday we have a segment called It's a Wonderful Wednesday, where the idea behind this segment is that ever since this movie came out 78 years ago, there have been a lot of mediums that have taken the basic premise of the movie and used it try to use it for their own for their own stories. Like, what would happen if a character doesn't appear, you know, disappears? You know, you have characters that, you know, if a character doesn't appear, or an alternate universe or things like that. So, you know, over the last 26 weeks, every week we talk about something else. And this time I decided I'm going to actually go with something from the theater. You know, there's a play that actually takes this idea. So I've actually never seen it. I've only read about it, that you have the Harry Potter play, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, where the idea of that play is that, you know, the sons of Harry and Draco, Albus and Scorpio, they decide to travel back in time in order to prevent Cedric from dying during the Triwizard Tournament. And when they do that, they end up changing everything around them, you know, by bringing Cedric back to life. So in the end, Ron and Hermione never get married. And then Albus and Harry, such a good relationship. And it turns out that Cedric still ends up dying. So they go back again and they do it a second time. And then they want to try once again to stop Cedric from dying. And they end up turning Cedric into a Death Eater, and they end up killing him. And then in the end, Harry ends up dying because Neville wasn't there in order to save Harry. And then Voldemort, takes over everything. So then they go back for the third time. And, you know, they stop everything that they did in order to, because they realize that it's better not to play with time, I guess you can say.
Yeah, there's a lot of time travel, and probably none of them are going to come to mind right now, where, you know, the main plot line is if you go back and change one thing, it changes everything.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, you know.
Of course.
But
I mean, the most the most connected to this movie is obviously Back to the Future, and then Back to the Future 2. You know, you have there you have Hill Valley, which I'm still shocked that, you know, Biff didn't call it Tannersville or something like that, because we do have Pottersville, you know. But you know, that's the closest that you get to. And you know, they've done it so many times.
It's a Wonderful Life can be looked at as a riff on A Christmas Carol, you know, instead of, it's the same storyline. You know, instead of ghosts, it's an angel. Angels could be considered ghosts and vice versa, but it's not a totally original story when it comes to the overall plot line, but it's been done. I'm sure if you've talked about this quite a few times throughout the podcast, you know, this film has been remade. It was remade with a woman.
Yes, of course. With the
TV movie and Marlo Thomas.
Marlo Thomas. Yes, I've talked about that one. Yes. I rewatched it. It's okay. Because it takes because I like this movie. So they take the basic premise and just do a gender switch. That's all they do. But part of the gender switch certain aspects of the story don't work as well. You know, the fact that they had to make George deaf in one ear is in order for him to not be able to go off to war, you know, but
exactly.
But in that movie, because, you know, the character is a woman, she doesn't have to worry about that. Her husband ends up going off to war and gets injured while he's, you know, while he's fighting overseas. But they don't need to. So they take out the whole thing about her having to save her brother and all that stuff, you know, so it doesn't work as well. But it was fun to and come on, you got to admit, it's good seeing Orson Welles playing Potter. You know,
it was good seeing Orson Welles playing Potter. I think I saw that movie when it first aired. You know, it was a TV movie and did not like it. Probably didn't like it more because I was of the thought, how dare they? And probably should see it again just to see if it changes my opinion.
Okay, I recommend you should go in with an open mind. Again, it's not going to be better than It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, I've talked about, you know, 26 different things. I don't think I've come across any that I would say takes the idea of It's a Wonderful Life and does it better than It's a Wonderful Life does, because this, you know, Capra did it perfectly.
Yes.
And, you know, and it doesn't matter what I mean, we talked about different TV shows. You know, they had an episode of Mork and Mindy. They had an episode of Laverne and Shirley. There was an episode of Married with Children that we've talked about. We talked about Mad About You. I mean, all these different TV shows that take the premise and it works within their structure, but it's still not as impactful as they do here.
No.
Exactly.
It can't be. Under a, you know, 23-minute, 25-minute time limit, and the writing on all of Capra's films was key, and the writing in this film, and you know, and the running time allowed Capra to, you know, go for the heartstrings. And he does, and it works. I mean, and it really works, because, you know, no matter how many times people see this film, and now they see it at least once a year, every single time they cry.
Yeah.
Every time. I mean, it's, you know, and there are other films that do the same thing to me and to a lot of other people. No matter how many times you watch it, you're still going to tear up, and you know exactly when you're going to tear up, and this film is one of them. You know, I saw Capra in person give a lecture after screening It's a Wonderful Life in Philadelphia, and he had a Q&A afterwards, and someone raised their hand and said, two questions, Mr. Capra. One, why do you feel this film is so relevant today? And then the second part of the question was, why did you have to bring George Bailey down to achieve your purpose? And he kind of blew off the second part of the question, because it really wasn't a good question. But the relevancy, he said, you know, whenever I make all of my movies, I try to think of what a viewer 50 years later would think if they watched my movie. So I tried to make the movie, my movies, timely forever. And if you look at Capra's work, in particular, It's a Wonderful Life or Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or even, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, most of his movies still are relevant today. They still work today. And a lot of other filmmakers had the same feeling, you know. I mean, most of Ford's movies work today, but Capra's, especially ones that kind of, you know, veer towards the political side of our country here, in, you know, in the United States, they still work. They still resonate. And that's it was very interesting to hear him say that.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah. It was. He came to Philadelphia and three nights in a row, he screened It's a Wonderful Life. He screened It Happened One Night. And then the third night, he screened State of the Union. And did
I'm actually a big fan of State of the Union. It's great. I know a lot of people haven't seen it, but I really liked what he did there. You know, that's the, that was the only set. That was the second movie, the second and only movie from Liberty Films. You know, they weren't that successful.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I mean, they made two great movies, but no one appreciated them at the time. So,
Yeah, exactly.
You're right. All right. So, Joe, would you like to tell people where they can find you?
They can find me in my house in Langhorne, Pennsylvania.
I don't think you want people breaking down your door coming to visit you.
It's nice. It's 60-some degrees here today, and it'll be 40 again on Saturday. But no, you can find me online. You know, virgilfilms.com is our website, and we have all of our information on there. And, you know, it'll the website will tell you all of the different things we do. And if you would like, when you go to the website, there is a section for a president's blog and podcasts. And we are putting up podcasts that I appear in, including Movie Rob, and you can take a gander and listen to listen to some podcasts that I've been a part of.
All right, very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.